We turn now to Jesus and the affections, the Great Awakening. Folks, they did not call the colonial revival the first Great Awakening. Why? Because they didn't know there was going to be a second one, obviously. But this is, in fact, the second, the first of the Great Awakenings. In the first few decades of the 18th century, by most accounts, the religious fervor of 17th century Puritanism in America moderated. Folks, all religious, bless you, all religious intensities moderate. Folks, all religious intensities moderate. And as this religious intensity moderated, some of the heirs of Puritanism began to adapt some form of the Arminian theology that Miss Hutchinson had charged the first generation Puritan ministers with adopting. They weren't Arminians. Now we're beginning to get some real Arminians. These are folks who in the late 17th and early 18th century embraced the new world view that we call in the West the Enlightenment. The 18th century Enlightenment, with its emphasis on reason and rationality. The Enlightenment, with its basically optimistic view of humanity and human nature. And ministers, in all kinds of ways and in all places, began to make more room for human agency, for human effort in the process of salvation. And as this was going on, right at the same time, much of Western Europe and the English colonies were swept by a remarkable revival of pietistic religion that doesn't seem to fit in the Enlightenment, because this revival of pietistic religion its emphasis is not on reason, but emotion. Its emphasis is not on the head, but on the heart. Now, the revival occurs everywhere. In Western Europe and here. For instance, in Central Europe, there was a pietistic group that came to be called the Moravians, because that's where they were from. The Moravians traced their lineage back to the first of the radical reformers with their attack on all ecclesiological ceremony and hierarchy. The Moravians insisted on the importance of the individual's direct connection to and communication with God. They insisted that the individual must directly communicate and can directly communicate and be connected with God. In England, the revival was marked by a revival within the old staid Church of England. This is the Methodist revival that we associate with two brothers named John and Charles Wesley. And with their colleague, a remarkable orator named George Whitefield, spelled Whitefield. The Methodist revival, first in England and in the English colonies, emphasized the necessity of the conversion experience. This comes to be called the evangelical conversion experience. Evangelical. The root word is evangelist. What does the word evangelist mean? Can anyone tell me? What does an evangelist do? Brings the good news. Proclaims the good news. And the good news is that God died for you in the form of Jesus. Let's proclaim it. And at the essence of that evangelical experience was a once-in-a-lifetime, life-transforming rearrangement of the heart, which we call conversion. Once in a lifetime, you can confront God, and your life is forever changed. Young people, no one in George W. Bush's America should doubt the power of evangelical conversion experiences. And if our president was here, he would tell you that. Jesus changed his life instantly one time. All righty. A conversion experience is that point in your life when you decide to accept the salvific gift of God's grace as seen in Jesus' death on the cross. The atonement. The evangelical conversion experience was at the basis of the Methodist revival. In the English colonies, the revivals that came to be called the Great Awakening occur roughly between 1730 and 1765. Now, they do not occur all at the same place, all at the same time. One colony had it in the 1730s, another in the 1740s, another in the 1750s and in the 60s. But they all have in common these evangelical ideals. This revival in America is dominated by a single great man whose name is Jonathan Edwards. And we're going to talk more about Edwards. Edwards is a colossal figure in the history of American religion and American thought. Because in the 1720s, 30s, and 40s, this most intelligent man that maybe America has ever produced, this great philosopher, tried to resurrect original Calvinism in the English colonies. It's a very complicated story, but Edwards believed he was a real Calvinist. But he tried to resurrect Calvinism with the tools of the Enlightenment. I don't have time to tell you that story, but we're going to hint at it in just a minute. The result, ironically, is that Edwards helps increase the focus on and emphasis upon emotional religion in America. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. All of these revivals had several things in common. And the most important is that they all emphasize the heart and emotion. Now, when we talk about people under the influence of emotion in religion, what do we think of? What vision comes to our mind? What is it? Baptists. Well, most Baptists I know are very staid. What? Yeah, Southern God, what are they doing? They're waving and singing. What else are they doing? What is it? They are speaking in tongues. They're falling down. They're slain in the spirit. They're getting healed. They're throwing away crutches. Right? Folks, can we go back to the 18th century? Can we be 18th century people here? Jonathan Edwards would have been appalled and would have told you to sit down. That's not the way you behave in church. All right. So what do they mean by emotion? It's not excitement, exuberance, irrationality. All of this, any 18th century philosopher or orator would have called enthusiasm. Now, what do we mean by enthusiasm? Hook 'em, right? That's not what they mean. Enthusiasm is when all of your emotions get out of control. And enthusiasm is always a bad thing. What is the little UT service group that jumps around a lot in services and no, Oh, I don't think they're there anymore. But there used to be this one group of UT kids, and they were a service organization. And they were the most peppy kids I ever saw in my life. I just wanted to slap them. Sit down, settle down. All enthusiastic. We don't trust enthusiasm. For 18th century philosophers, the emotions properly understood were called the affections. What do you mean when you say that you feel affection for someone? Usually it means you tell them that you don't really love them. You have warm feelings about them. Yeah. Affection. The affections for mid-18th century thinkers were deeply felt emotions that were the seat, get this down, deeply felt emotions that were the seat of all purposive and constructive action. In order to persuade someone to do something, you had to, they would use the word address, engage, get a hold of the affections. In evangelical Christianity, you did that through the Word. Not through those Catholic pictures, but by the Word, by using language that vividly described what you were attempting to convey. Now, the primary affective sermon associated with the Great Awakening was preached by Jonathan Edwards. Do you know what its name was? Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Now, have you ever heard little debaters or oratorical people preach Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God? They usually scream and carry on and say, you're going to hell. What is the metaphor that John Edwards uses for the sinner? Sinners in the hands of, what is the metaphor? It's an animal. How many of you know the answer to that question? The spider held over eternal flames by what? A single thread. Put strand and thread together, you have a thread. A thread of webbing held by whom? What kind of God? An angry God who by all rights should do what? Let go, sizzle spider, right? Okay? And these little kids, they will preach like Miller preaches and all this kind of stuff. No, Jonathan Edwards never cracked a smile. He certainly didn't move his hands. He would often preach Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, looking at the bell rope behind everybody. Didn't even look at you. Why? Because the way in which he said these words was not important. What was important? The words. His description of hell. His description of the awful majesty and sovereignty of God. And his description of your lost, appropriately lost estate. And it worked. Because language then had not yet been debased. In order to get your attention, I have to make a fool of myself up here. I wouldn't, in case you haven't noticed. But language could do the work himself. You engage the affections simply through language. Now, if you did that carelessly, if you began to get out of control, what might happen? If you began to get out of control, what might happen? Come on. The people you were preaching at might get out of control. And what did the 18th century people, what did the 18th century thinkers call people out of control? The mob. The rabble. Mob. So you have to be careful. Because if you go too far, you will enlist not their affections, but what else? What other faculty? Their, because of the P, passions. And you can't control the passions. The passions are not seats of they're not seats of purposive action. They're the seat of destructive action. So you have to engage the affections carefully in order to get people to do something. And over all of that, you then had to get to the most sophisticated and most powerful of all the faculties. And this was called the capital U understanding. The understanding took all of the other faculties' messages that was coming into you and integrated them. And they turned all of this stuff into purposive actions that you intend. Now, yes. The question is simple. Let's get this straight. This, folks, what does the word irony mean? I didn't say that. Actually, this is a very good question. I'm very serious. This is a good question. What does the word irony mean? You all laughed. So we all kind of know. But what does it mean? The unexpected results of actions can be ironical, right? And the sort of the simultaneous occurrence of two diametrically opposed things. The Enlightenment and the great Pietistic revival of the 18th century occurred when? Exactly at the same time. That's just ironical. Meet life. Alrighty? Now, your furrowed brows are coming apart, are coming about because Edwards tried to have it both ways. And he couldn't. Not even Jonathan Edwards. Now, folks, if you want to understand that, take another course. Read George Marsden's great biography. It didn't work. He's one of the great casualties of trying to do too much. The end result, though, is that all revivals, all of the revival experience of the mid-18th century finally emphasizes heartfelt, emotional religion. That was a very good question because I forgot to talk about irony. Okay? Now, I'm going to illustrate this the only way I can, because I don't got no pictures. No pictures. We're Protestants now. With music. And I'm going to introduce to you a new music form, which is one of the most important products of the Reformation, especially in English-speaking lands. What new form of music is it? The hymn. The hymns are one of the most important products of the Great Awakening. Now, unless you are an Episcopalian or somebody like that, you folks have forgotten about hymns, right? And, well, some of you don't, but most of you have forgotten about hymns, and you have the execrable Christian music and what all that kind of stuff. What do you call it? Praise music. Jesus is wonderful. Jesus is wonderful. Jesus is wonderful. Well, we can make that more complicated, and they did. I thoroughly recommend them to you. There's nothing quite like them in other expressions of Christianity. The English hymns are, first of all, written in the vernacular. That shouldn't surprise you. They're to be sung not by a choir, but by whom? The people, like the German chorale. But the hymns were sung only by the people. And unlike the Psalms, and unlike the theological discursions of the Reformation, the hymns are written in rather emotional, affective language. And the center of that language is Jesus. Did you hear what I said? Emotional, affective language, at the center of which is our man, not God so much, Jesus. For the hymns are the way in which evangelical Protestants begin to identify powerfully with Jesus. Here, Jesus, the Word, took a new powerful shape that had great emotive force in the text of these hymns. Folks, people loved these hymns and they cherished these hymns. Folks, one of my great fears, I may have already told you this, is that my last dying thought is going to be the second verse of the Old Rugged Cross. I know all of them because guess where they are? After my mind goes, they will still be in my heart, in my soul, because I'm a product of this culture. Now, most of you are not, because the great hymns are no longer at the... Talk to your mama, or your great-grandmother, about the... If you're a Protestant, talk to them at the... What she wants to have sung at her funeral. The Old Rugged Cross, something like that. Very powerful. What the Catholics did with their pictures and their statues, evangelical Protestants did with the words, the words, the words, the words, and the music now of their hymns. And it is in these great hymns of evangelical Protestantism that Jesus, the incarnate God, begins the process that we will follow the rest of the semester of dominating Protestant understandings of the Trinity. These are important. For the Puritans, Jesus was primarily the part of the Trinity that had paid the price for redemption. Said again. For the Puritans, Jesus was primarily the part of the Trinity that paid the price of redemption. And they focused on the sovereignty of God that allowed him to even think about saving us. In the 18th century revival, evangelical revivalists instead focused on Jesus paying that price. The Puritans didn't, folks. When Southern Baptist Dr. Biller went to graduate school at the University of Michigan, I took a course with a great man. And it was on the 18th century, 17th, 18th century. I thought I would write my first graduate school paper on Puritan sermons on the Passion and Jesus, Jesus' role in the Passion. So I began to read. There weren't any. There weren't any. Didn't focus on the Passion. And certainly didn't focus on Jesus' role in it. The Passion was just the way the elect got redeemed, or the price was paid. Now we focus on the act of redemption. And they talk over and over and over again about grace. The unmerited salvific gift of Jesus' sacrifice on the cross. The cross dominated this hymnology. If I say the word grace, for a Protestant, it should come with a word in front of it. And the word is amazing. Amazing Grace, the most popular hymn probably ever written in the English language, was written by a young man named John Newton. A poor young man, English. He was impressed, forced to serve in the English Navy. And there was brutalized by the English Navy. And in the 1740s became a slaver. Worked on a slave ship. And engaged in some of the most brutal activities going on in the world at the time. But in 1748, John Newton experienced something that comes to be kind of a trope, a T-R-O-P-E, something that recurs over and over again in evangelical experience. The same thing happened to John Wesley and to George Whitefield. They were on a sea voyage, and they had a storm, and they got frightened because they were going to die, and they had some sort of intense experience with God. And for John Newton, he was converted. He said of the experience, "The Lord came from on high and delivered me out of deep waters." I love that metaphor. Came from on high, took him out of deep waters. He was ordained to the Anglican ministry and became part of the evangelical wing of the Anglican church. He never became a Methodist and left the church. He stayed in the church, but he remained an evangelical. I hope that you know the words of Amazing Grace. They are effective words. You have them in your lap now. We are called wretches. We are lost but are now found. The actions of God in our soul are sweet. It refers over and over again to the heart, to light, and to this, and in the words of this former slaver, it refers to freedom. Life here is a journey leading home, and home is eternal bliss with God and with His Son. I would like to play for you Jesse Norman singing Amazing Grace. A lot of emphasis in these hymns on seeing, not pictures, but Jesus Himself. We must be instructed, taught. Life is a struggle. The most famous of the English. Yes, ma'am. Isaac Watts wrote the words of this film. Wrote the words. He did not write the music. This is a traditional folk tune. Ready? Good question. Thank you, Mark. All of the English hymn writers of the last half of the 18th century are heirs to the great Isaac Watts. And Isaac Watts is the one who really put the emphasis on the cross in his hymns and put it at the center of evangelical religion. The most famous of his hymns is "Alas, and Did My Savior Bleed? And Did My Sovereign Die? Would he devote that sacred head for such a worm as I? Was it for crimes that I have done he groaned upon the tree? Amazing pity, grace unknown, and love beyond degree." I would like for you now to take in your hymnal, or whatever you want to call that, and turn that "Amazing Grace" over. There you see, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross." We know that words to this hymn. How do you know the words to this hymn? Oh, that's interesting. This is not the tune you're going to know. This is really a fascinating hymn. Note what it's based on. Gregorian chant. This hymn is about looking. "When I survey the wondrous cross." And then in the third verse, "See from his head." They direct your gaze. "I'm here looking with you." And then the hymn writer instructs you, directs you. "See from his head, his hands, his feet." But you're not looking at a picture, are you? Where are you looking? Where are you looking? Where can you look? Where is the only place you can look? Inward. Thank you, Mary. Inward. Folks, the evangelical is always sending you inward. And this hymn beautifully illustrates the educative role of all evangelical discourse. All evangelical preaching and teaching is to instruct you. So you're always stepping back and telling someone what they're supposed to be learning from the looking experience. So what do we have here? "When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory dies," what happens? "My richest gain I count but loss, and pour contempt on all my pride." Your understanding is telling your emotions what to feel and what to do. So, and then we learn a lesson. And it's going to lead us to say, "Forbid it, Lord, that I should boast, save in the death of Christ my God. All the vain things that charm me most, I sacrifice them to his" what? "Blood." Blood. "Given for your sins." And here then, blood begins to dominate the image that you're seeing. See, oh folks, these metaphors are just brilliant. "See from his head, his hands, his feet. Sorrow and love flow mingled down." No, that's not what's flowing mingled down from Jesus' body. What is flowing down? Water and blood. But it's being transformed here into metaphor, words to instruct you. And then it teaches you a lesson. "Did e'er such love and sorrow meet, or thorns compose so rich a crown?" Then he goes back to the cross. And this is incredible. His dying crimson. What? Blood. Like a robe. Folks, the blood is like a robe. Spreads o'er his body on a tree. "Then am I dead to all the globe, and all the globe is dead to me." Then you have to really get a message from the understanding and learn the most important thing from this. Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were a present far too small, love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. This is an epitome of the evangelical hymn and evangelical religion instructing. When I survey. This is a very English performance. This is St. John's College Choir. Solo turn. That strange instrument that you hear accompanying the choir is called an no guitar. You laugh. I would like to conclude by saying some words about Jesus and Jonathan Edwards. But that is a misnomer, because Jonathan Edwards does not talk about Jesus. Like the fourth gospel, like John, Jonathan Edwards talks about the Christ, the risen Christ. One of the themes of Edwards' sermons is what he calls the excellence of Christ. You get no sense of the historical Jesus from Edwards at all. His focus is almost exclusively on the risen Christ. He says in one of his writings that he began to have, now folks, don't try to take this down because I'm about to give it to you. You already have it, actually. He began to have a new apprehension, understanding, and ideas of Christ. and the work of redemption and the glorious way of salvation by him. An inward sweet sense of these things at times came into my heart, and my soul was led away in pleasant views and contemplations of them. And in my mind was greatly engaged to spend my time in reading and meditating on Christ, on the beauty and excellency of his person, and the lovely way of salvation by free grace to him. In that night, he found Christ in the Song of Songs, in the Rose of Sharon canticle. He found it in what he called all innered sweetness, and through it found, quote, a calm abstraction of soul from the concerns of this world, and sometimes a kind of vision or fixed idea and imaginations of being alone in the mountains or some solitary wilderness, far from all mankind, sweetly conversing with Christ and wrapped and swallowed up in God. The sense I had of divine things would often of a sudden kindle up, as it were, a sweet burning in my heart, an ardor of soul that I know not how to express. Folks, that is what is meant by affections. The altered apprehension of Christ leads Edwards to a new understanding of God. He tells us that he once had a conversation with his earthly father, and then he went for a walk, again in the midst of nature, in the pasture. He looked into the sky, and there came into mind so sweet a sense of the glorious majesty and grace of God that I know not how to express it. I seem to see them both in a sweet conjunction, God and Jesus, majesty and meekness joined together. It was a sweet and gentle and holy majesty, and also a majestic meekness, an awful sweetness, a high and great and holy gentleness. And all this sense of divine things gradually increased and became more and more lively and more of that inward, what's the word? Sweetness. The appearance of everything was altered. God's excellency, his wisdom, his purity and power seem to appear in everything. He's all out in the midst of nature. He sees the mountains and everything. But unlike the transcendentalist later on, he's not transformed by nature. He's transformed by going inside himself. Now, you have narration from which this is taken. Please read it. All righty. Now, I have 1 minute. Yes. That's what predestination. He tries to bring it back. It doesn't work, and he loses his job.